What is time? We cannot see it, feel it, or hear it. Yet it holds us in a relentless grip. It compels us into the future and imprisons the past in the tomb of memory. But what if we made time our servant, shaping it to our desire? That is the mind-bending premise of H.G. Wells' classic novel, The Time Machine. Published in 1895, when the British-born Wells was only 29, The Time Machine's vision extends beyond science fiction. At its heart, the story is about mankind and our fate as human beings on Earth. As we evolve, will our souls lift us to a higher plane? Or will our greed and violent nature condemn us to depraved depths? Wells wrapped his conjecture in the captivating tale of a brave inventor whose greatest invention may, in fact, be the very story he tells. But you will be the judge of that. Our journey into the future begins in the past, near the turn of the last century, after a civilized dinner at the time traveler's London home, recalled by his best friend, Philby. Time traveler had become enthralled with his own explanation, and his excitement began to affect us. His gray eyes twinkled, and his usual pale face became flushed and animated.
Yes, this is delicious, I think. Your education.
I'm
is
telling
useless.
You, gentlemen,
your education
that a formal
is
education
useless.
Is absolutely necessary.
Useless.
Especially
oh,
in the
useless.
I mean, our children need it.
Useless, gentlemen. Oh, gentlemen, please, all I'm asking you to do is question what you were taught in school.
Yes.
Follow me carefully, please. You'll see that every geometry lesson was wrong.
How
could you say such a thing?
The very idea.
I mean, I beg your pardon, John.
Hear me out. Hear me out. Philby, please. Let me explain, my friends.
We're waiting.
After all, it's nearly 1900, a new century. We are on the brink of an age of science. We can't afford to look at this new world in the old way.
And why not? Mankind has been well served for thousands of years.
Has it? Absolutely. Has it? No. Has it really? What we call civilization is little more than the history of war interrupted by moments of uncertain peace. Surely mankind aspires to something greater than that.
Yes, but what does this have to do with geometry, John?
Everything, Philby, everything. A new age demands new thinking. And what better place to start than with the physical nature of reality? The dimensions of height, width, and depth.
Now we're back to something I understand.
Then I'll start by asking you, Samuel. Imagine a cube.
Fair enough. A cube. Continue.
A cube has height, width, and depth. But does it really exist?
Of course it does.
Are you sure? Are you sure? Your cube exists only in your mind.
Is this some kind of practical joke?
No. But your cube, Samuel, is a theoretical cube, an abstraction.
What are you driving at, John?
Just this, Philby. I have a real cube in this drawer. Now place it on this real table. We can all see this cube, not Samuel's imaginary one.
Go on.
Now it has three dimensions, height, width, and depth. But suppose we subtract one dimension, say depth.
What?
Does the cube still exist?
No. If it only has two dimensions, it would be a square.
Right, Philby. Does a square exist?
Of course. I can draw you one.
No. You can draw a picture of a square, James, but an actual square cannot actually exist.
Give me a piece of paper, and I'll prove you wrong.
You'll prove me right. The paper has depth. The pencil line has depth, even if only microscopic. But we can still theorize a square. That's called the study of geometry.
All well and good, John, but what does this have to do with the real world?
Something so basic that I'm astonished science hasn't thought of it before. A fourth dimension.
You've had too much port wine, John.
And you have had too much practical education, Samuel. Where is your imagination?
No,
clearly, gentlemen, an object must exist in four directions. Not just length, width, and depth, but also duration. In other words, time. Everybody overlooks this simple fact. Our world contains four dimensions, three of which we call space, and a fourth, time. Is that any clearer?
Very clear, John, I think.
Nonsense. It's not clear at all. I can see if an object is tall or wide or deep. But as for its existence in time, it's irrelevant.
Always being practical, aren't you, Samuel? Well, I can be practical, too. For instance, here are photographs of a man at 8 years of age, another at 15, another at 23, and so on. These are examples of his travel through time.
Uh-huh.
You look skeptical, Colin.
I'm a doctor, John. I can only treat what I can prove experimentally.
Then let me show you an experiment. Wait here. I'll be right back.
Where's he going?
This is quite a conversation this evening.
The time traveler smiled at us mischievously. Then he walked slowly out of the room, and we heard his slippers scuffling down the long hallway to the laboratory. He returned with a box, out of which he lifted a glittering metal framework, scarcely larger than a small clock, and very delicately made. The small device looked like a doll's carriage, with a saddle for a seat, brass rails around it, exquisitely small ivory-handled control levers, and a transparent crystalline device affixed to its back. He set the object before us on the table. We gathered around him, all on the alert, ready for a trick. Unconcerned with our doubts, he rested his elbows on the table while we all peered closely at this wondrous-looking toy.
Gentlemen, this is my prototype for a machine to travel through time.
It's beautifully made. It's like a toy.
No, James, this is not a toy. It took 2 years for me to make.
2 years on that?
That's right, Samuel. But what is time, huh?
I can never tell when you're joking, John.
If I press this tiny lever, I send the machine gliding into the future. Pull it back, and it goes into the past. This seat is where the time traveler will sit. Have a good look at it, gentlemen. Look at the table, open it, check for trap doors and mirrors. Satisfy yourselves that there is no trickery. I don't want to waste this model and then have you tell me that I'm a charlatan.
Well, I'll look under the table.
Please do. Check solid. It. Check it carefully.
Oh, there are no mirrors.
Good.
Well, of course we believe you, John.
Good. Now, Samuel, since you're the most skeptical, lend me your hand.
What's that?
I said lend me your hand.
Why? Whatever for?
You shall press the ivory lever that launches my machine on its maiden journey through time.
What's it doing?
It's glimmering.
It's growing dimmer.
The machine's moving.
No, but it's not.
It's turning gray.
It's blurry. It's getting blurry.
It's gone.
What have you done with it, John?
There was a breath of wind in the room, and a lamp flame flared up as though a gas jet had opened up. The room suddenly seemed to move slightly, and the table holding the machine trembled. John looked from his machine to each of our faces, then back to his invention. The tiny machine suddenly rose above the table on its own, swung around, became blurry, and it was gone. So it was that Samuel, or rather his pudgy hand, sent the model time machine on its maiden voyage.
Good heavens, John.
Where is it?
Where did it go? Come, John, where is it?
Gone in time, Colin.
Do you mean to say that machine has traveled into the past?
Oh, I doubt the past.
Why?
Because if it traveled into the past, then it would already have been on this table when we arrived at John's house tonight.
That's right, James. Have I made you a believer?
If seeing is believing, you have.
It will take more than a magician's trick to convince me.
Samuel, you inspected the table.
You've invented some new sleight of hand, is it?
I've invented something, all right. Would you like to see the time machine itself?
Huh? What are you saying, John? Have you built more of these toys?
No, not toys, Philby, not toys. The real thing.
It isn't possible.
It is. And if you'll follow me, I'll show you.
Oh, of all the unbelievable...
Just please, everybody, follow me. Follow me.
Did you have
anything about this? Utter rubbish.
Taking a lamp in his hand, he led us down the long, drafty corridor into his private quarters. It was the first time he had ever allowed me inside, and for good reason. He had raised disorder to an art form. Scattered books and dishes lay among machine tools and workbenches. And there it stood, in the center of the room, alone and imposing, the time machine, It was a larger version of the mechanism we had just seen vanish from before our eyes. Parts of it were of nickel, parts of ivory, parts had been filed out of rock crystal. A brass rail surrounded this one too, and it shimmered brightly in the lamplight. In a frightening way, it was beautiful.
You are serious.
I was never more serious in my life, James. With this machine, I intend to explore time.
Even after we saw it, none of us quite believed in the time machine. The time traveler showed us its glowing instruments and burnished fittings, but did so with such whimsy that I dare say we distrusted his seriousness. The Thursday evening ended, as did those before it, with cordial valedictions and being shown to the door by Mrs. Watchett, our host's fastidious housekeeper.
Well, here's your hat, Mr. Philby. Mr. Philby?
Oh, yes, thank you, Mrs. Watcher. Mm-hmm. Another lovely dinner, as always.
Well, thank you. You'll all be back next Thursday, I trust.
Well, if you'll have us, Mrs. Watcher.
Absolutely. Yeah. 7 o'clock sharp.
Seven as usual?
Yes, I can almost tell time by you.
What? Well, thank you, Mrs. Watcher.
You're welcome. Thank you. Good night.
Yes.
Good night. Good night.
I'm afraid none of us really thought very much about time travel between that Thursday and the next, when we again gathered at our eccentric friend's home for supper. Colin, Samuel, James, and I assembled as usual at 7 sharp, but instead of being greeted by our host, it was Mrs. Watchett who...
Oh, hello, Colin.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good
to see you, Mrs.
Watchett. Ah, gentlemen. Well? Gentlemen, right on time as always, Mr. Philby. I have a letter for you, courtesy of himself.
And where is himself tonight, Mrs. Watchett?
Well, if his letter doesn't tell you, I'm sure I have no idea.
Really?
Mm. How long has he been gone?
Only since this morning, Mr. Samuel, but for the last week, he's hardly stepped outside of his workshop, not even to eat.
So where is he now?
I haven't a clue, sir. There was a strange sound early this morning, and then nothing. He hasn't set foot out of his laboratory since.
Did you go in?
Oh, I didn't dare.
Well, haven't you at least knocked on his door?
Oh, no, sir. I did that once, a few days ago, and I thought he'd scold me clear out to sea. I need my privacy, he says. Never mind the rest of it, and the world be damned. Leave me to my work. Such language.
Work or no, it's not like John to miss Thursday dinner, especially in his own house.
Now come into the dining room, gentlemen. My instructions were to have food on the table at 7, regardless. Who knows what he has planned?
Then I suggest we repair to the table and not disappoint him.
Would you open the letter, Philby?
Oh, yes, yes, of course, the letter. Well, it's from John, all right.
Well, we assumed as much. Read it. Out loud.
It just says that he may be delayed joining us, but to start dinner without him.
Oh, let me see that.
Dear friends, I may be delayed this evening, but have instructed Mrs. Watcher to feed you promptly at 7 o'clock. Do not wait for me to begin, but think of me as you do. I shall arrive in good time. Well, what do you make of that?
Damnedest thing.
What else does he say?
That's it.
It's odd. But time is sacred to John. I'm certain he'll be here. Meanwhile, Mrs. Watchett, what treasures have you planned for your celebrated dinner table? It smells delicious.
It's a roast this evening, Mr. James. A full joint it is, with trimmings and a pudding.
Samuel, would you take a drink with me?
Absolutely, Colin, absolutely. Philby?
Mrs. Watchett's dinner was, even by our own standards, superb. What a pity that our host wasn't there to enjoy it with us. Strange. But as tight-knit a group of friends as we were, John's absence seemed to separate rather than unite us, as though we required his company in order to function.
On the rare side.
John!
It's John!
Oh, look at you!
Where have you been, man?
Get him a seat!
Get him a drink!
Now, what on earth have you been up to?
Sit over here.
Say something! What's wrong with you? Speak to us!
The time traveler was a sight. His coat was dusty and dirty and smeared with green down the sleeves. His hair was disheveled and seemed to be grayer, either with dirt or because its color had actually faded. His face was ghastly pale. His chin had a cut on it, a cut half-healed. For a moment he hesitated, as if dazzled by the light in the room. Please, John, are you all right?
Yes. Yes, I'm all right.
Not by medical standards, you're not.
I truly am. I truly am. All right, Colin. I am. Just please let me have some of that food. I'm starving for a bit of meat.
Yes.
One word. Please, just one word first. Have you been time traveling?
Yes.
Now I'll need a drink.
Yes, really. I'll make that too.
I have lived 8 days. Days that no human being ever lived before. But I must tell you what I saw.
Oh, yes, of course, John.
Yes, please. No interruptions. Agreed?
Absolutely.
Yes, of course.
Then prepare yourselves for a story such as you've never heard before. It was at 10 o'clock today that my time machine and I began our career. I gave it a last tap, tried all the screws again, put one more drop of oil on the quartz rod, and sat myself in the saddle. I suppose a suicide who holds a pistol to his skull feels much the same wonder at what will come next. I took the starting lever in one hand and nudged it forward. Almost at once, I felt a sensation of falling, and I pulled it back to stop. Looking round, I saw the laboratory exactly as before. Nothing had happened. And then I saw the clock. A moment before, it had said 10:01. Now, it was nearly 3:30. I drew a breath. I set my teeth, gripping the starting lever with both hands, and went off into time. The visual sensation of time travel is unlike any other kind of movement. At first, the laboratory got hazy and went dark. Though I remained in one place, the room around me moved at increasing speed, like a kinetograph film running out of control. I was amused to see Mrs. Watchett come into the room and walk toward the garden door, apparently without seeing me. I suppose it took her a minute or so in her time to cross the space, but to me, she seemed to shoot across the room like a rocket. Feeling more assured of my device, I pressed the control lever still farther. The night arrived, like the turning out of a lamp, and in another moment came tomorrow. Soon, day and night flickered rapidly like the flapping of a black wing. The laboratory grew fainter and even fainter. Tomorrow night came, then day again, night, day, faster and faster still, and suddenly, I broke through into the open air. Perhaps the laboratory had somehow been destroyed, but I was going too fast to notice any moving things. The flashing day and night were painful to watch, but as I gained even more speed, they soon merged into one continuous gray. I was still on the hillside on which the house now stands, but was plunging into the future at incalculable speed. I saw trees growing and changing like puffs of vapor, now brown, now green, then gray. They shriveled and died. I saw huge buildings built and raised, and I passed them like dreams. My pace was over a year a minute. Soon I began to ponder when and how I should stop, or even if I could. The risk was that when I did stop, some object might occupy the same space as the machine, and our forms would fuse. So long as I traveled at high velocity through time, this didn't matter. But to come to a stop involved jamming myself molecule by molecule into whatever lay in my way. I had feared this when I built my machine, but now it was a threatening reality. Would I become a prisoner of time? I decided to take a chance and slow down. If I perceived the darkness of a physical object around me, I would speed up till it was gone. If not, and I was in open air, I would bring my journey to a full rest. It was like rushing through a long tunnel, not knowing when the end would come. And despite my caution, I suddenly came to a halt, as though snagged on some element in time. My machine lurched violently, spun around and tumbled over, and I was flung headlong out of it onto the ground. I had arrived in a violent storm. My gauge showed that I was in the year 802,701 and in some kind of lush garden and getting drenched to the skin with warm rain. The most profound sensation I had, however, was the sweet smell of flowers and clean earth, not at all like the dusty showers of our city rainstorms today. I righted my machine. I saw no apparent damage and looked through the downpour. A colossal figure, carved apparently in some white stone, loomed indistinctly beyond the bushes in the hazy downpour. As the rain let up, I saw the white figure more distinctly. It was very large, of white marble, shaped something like a winged sphinx. It stood on a base of bronze, and its sightless eyes seemed to be watching me. Had the human race renewed its faith in pagan gods? I looked more curiously at this world of the remote future. It looked almost pastoral. And then I saw, peering through the bushes, a group of young children. They'd seen me, and from what I could sense by their manner, were deciding whether to come forward.
Hello? Please, don't be afraid. I won't hurt you. It's all right to come out.
One approached me, bravely. He was perhaps 4 feet tall, wearing a purple tunic and sandals. His head was bare. And when I saw him more closely, I realized he was not a child, but a fully grown man. Or was he? He was certainly a very graceful creature, but indescribably frail. There we stood, I and this fragile thing from the future. He came a step forward, hesitated, then touched my hand. The absence of any sign of fear from this man struck me at once.
Hello. I say hello.
Hello?
Do you speak English? What is your name?
Hello? Name?
Where am I? What is this place? Oh, I have so much to ask you. Do you understand me at all?
Understand?
They grasped my language almost as a child would struggle with new words. My man from the future spoke a few words at the others, and presently they all encircled me, perhaps 8 or 10 of these exquisite creatures. And then I felt other soft little hands on my back and shoulders. They wanted to make sure I was real. When I saw the hands moving toward my time machine, I gently unscrewed the control lever and put it safely in my pocket. I had always anticipated that the people of the year 802,000 would be incredibly advanced in knowledge. But it never occurred to me that that would not be the case. Then my friend suddenly asked me a question.
Where did you come from?
Dear God, you can talk. You can't answer my questions. Yes. Speak to me again.
Did you come from the big noise in the sky?
The big noise? You mean the thunderstorm?
Thunderstorm?
Don't you know what a thunderstorm is?
Big noise from sky. Eloy scared.
Eloy. Your name is Eloy?
We are all Eloy.
A flow of disappointment rushed across my mind. 800,000 years into the future, and man, now calling himself Eloy, is reduced to the comprehension level of a preschool child. For a moment, I felt that I had built the time machine in vain. And then, one Eloy came toward me laughing, carrying a chain of beautiful flowers, and put it about my neck. One by one, they would run up to me, touch my hand or shirt, and scurry back to whisper among themselves like a brood of curious puppies when a stranger approaches. Apparently, I had become their new plaything. They nudged me along, away from the garden, and I soon saw another building beyond the Sphinx of white marble. This second building was a vast gray stone edifice. I left my time machine deserted in the garden, half hidden in the foliage. At the doorway of the stone building, several more brightly clad people met me, and we entered. I dressed in stuffy 19th century garments, and they clad in bright, soft-colored robes. They gestured with shining white limbs and chattered in a melodious whirl of laughter and childlike speech. The big doorway opened into a great hall. Along its length were tables made of slabs of polished stone and raised perhaps a foot from the floor. Upon these were bowls of fruit. Some I recognized, but for the most part they were strange to me. My new friends seated themselves at the table and motioned for me to do likewise. With complete absence of ceremony, they began to eat the fruit with their hands, flinging peels and stalks into openings on the sides of the tables. I followed their example, for I was thirsty and hungry. And as I ate, I surveyed the hall. What struck me the most was its dilapidated look. The stained glass windows were broken, and the curtains that hung across them were thick with dust. Impulsively, I asked the man eating beside me,
"What was this structure before it fell into such ruin?"
"Structure?"
"Yes, this place. Here, all around. Look, this hall. Surely it must have been something else before this."
"It was always. Here is where the Eloi eat."
"Are you not men and women?"
"We are Eloi."
"That is your name as a people. Surely you must have names for each of you."
"Names?"
"Oh, this is maddening. How do you speak to each other?"
"We just do. What are names?"
"One person. One Eloy. How do you speak to the one you want?"
"Mindo."
"What is Mindo?"
"Mindo is here."
The one I had just been trying to talk to smiled and pointed behind me, and there stood the very first creature I had met on my arrival.
"Mindo. Mindo."
"You? You are Mindo."
"I am Mindo."
"Yes, that's your name."
"Yes, my name is Mindo."
"My name is John."
"John. Mindo. Mindo. John."
"And where am I?"
"You are here."
I mean, the name of this land."
"This land is Eloy. This land is home."
It seemed futile, but I vowed to communicate with these people. Their world possessed all it needed to sustain physical life, and yet their intellectual lives had long ago atrophied from lack of use.
"I have so many questions about your world, Mindo. I only wish you knew the answers."
"Why questions when you have answers?"
"You know, I can't tell if you're being very simple or very complex."
"The Eloy have all we need. We have no use for your questions."
"But how long have you had all this? Don't you have to work for it?"
"Work?"
Work, labor, toil, doing things you don't want to do in order to do the things you do want to do.
I don't understand.
Well, you know, somehow I don't either. Theirs was a land and time of plenty, and yet they had no appreciation for it. They knew nothing of labor, tension, or war. The very food they ate was provided by nature's bounty. Fruit, by the way, seemed to be the Eloi's only diet. The people of the remote future will be strict vegetarians. What else of our future was I to glimpse as the days passed? In the days following my arrival, I found that horses, cattle, sheep, and even dogs had apparently followed the dinosaur into extinction. But the fruits were delightful. And so were these charming people, whose speech I made a resolute attempt to learn. I felt like a schoolmaster amidst children. It was slow work, and the little Eloi soon tired of lessons. More disheartening, I was taken by their almost complete lack of interest in acquiring knowledge. The one exception seemed to be the man called Mindo. If the Eloi were at the level of 5-year-olds, Mindo had the capacity of a boy of 10. Yet these people did not seem mentally unable to learn, just unused to it. How curious that in this paradise, the inhabitants had no use for the Tree of Knowledge. As I emerged from the Great Hall after eating that first day, the scene was lit by the setting sun. Everything was so different from the world I had known. I resolved to mount the summit of a crest, perhaps a mile and a half away, from which I could get a wider view of this, our planet, in the year 802,701 A.D. Hilltop, I realized that there were no houses to be seen. Apparently, the single-family house and possibly families themselves had vanished. Here, amid the greenery, were palace-like buildings, but the houses and cottages that formed so much a part of our own experience had disappeared. And on the heels of that came another thought. These people of the future are all alike. It seemed obvious that this close resemblance of the sexes was, after all, what one would expect. The strength of a man and the softness of a woman and the institution of the family and the necessity of labor are relics of an age of force, where population is balanced, where violence comes but rarely and offspring are secure, there's less need for the closed family. This, I must remind you, was my speculation at the time. Only later was I to discover how far it fell short of the reality. It came, oddly enough, by talking with Mindo, who had no idea of the import of his words. Mindo, please tell me something.
Tell you what?
Why are there no old Eloi?
Old?
Yes, old. People, Eloi, who've lived many years.
What is many years?
Time. Day upon day, through changes of season. You're born, grow up, and then... What happens when Eloi die?
I do not understand... Die.
How could I describe death to a being who has no concept of the value of life? Someone for whom one day is just like another until one day there are no more. And then a profound ennui settled upon me. It seemed to me that I had happened upon humanity on the wane. The vacant stares of Mindo and his brethren set me thinking of the twilight of mankind. For the first time, I realized that in the distant future,
a united humanity would triumph over nature. And the hollow harvest was what I saw. At that instant, I thought I had mastered the whole secret of these people. Could their population checks have succeeded too well? Had their number diminished rather than stabilized? That would account for the abandoned ruins. My explanation was plausible enough, as most wrong theories are. As I mused over this ironic triumph of man, the full moon came out. Bright little figures ceased to play below me, and I shivered in the approaching chill of night. I needed to find where I could sleep. I looked for the building I knew. Then my eye traveled to the figure of the Sphinx, growing distinct as the rising moon grew brighter. Below me was a tangle of bushes where I had landed, but as the moon came out, I could see the lawn more clearly, and the time machine was gone. Across my face came the possibility of losing my own age, of being left helpless in this strange world. The thought of it was a physical sensation. I could feel it grip me at the throat and stop my breathing. In another moment, I was caught with fear and found myself running down the slope. I fell headlong and I cut my face, but I spent no time stemming the flow of blood. When I reached the lawn, where my machine had been, my worst fears were realized. Not a trace of it was to be seen. I felt faint and cold when I faced the empty space among the black tangle of bushes. I ran round it furiously, as if the machine might be hidden in a corner. And then I stopped, with my hands clutching and pulling my hair. Above me towered the Sphinx upon the bronze pedestal, white, shining, leprous. In the light of the rising moon, it seemed to smile in mockery at my dismay. I had nothing left but misery. Finally, I slept. When I woke again, it was full day, and a couple of sparrows were hopping round me on the turf within reach of my arm. Then things came more clearly back to my rested mind. I saw the folly of frenzy over my predicament. If the machine was indeed lost, it behooved me to learn the ways of these people, to find tools and material to build another, if that was even possible. More likely, I told myself, the machine had only been taken away, moved somewhere by somebody I didn't know. I must be calm and patient and find its hiding place, and then recover it by cunning or force. It was useless to question the little people. The ground itself gave better counsel. I found a groove ripped in the lawn, about midway between the pedestal of the Sphinx and the marks of my feet, where on arrival I'd struggled with the overturned machine. In addition to the grooves, there were other signs, strange, narrow footprints like those I could imagine being made by an animal. I made my way to the pedestal of the large Sphinx and examined it more closely. The panels were not solid as they appeared from a distance. There were no handles or keyholes, so if there were doors, they would have to be opened from within. My time machine was inside that pedestal, but how it got there was a mystery. Presently, I saw two Eloi coming near. I smiled, and pointing at the pedestal, tried to convey my desire to open it. At this, they looked alarmed and ran off as if I'd insulted them. I tried asking others to no avail, but I was not beaten yet. I banged with my fist on the bronze panels. I thought I heard something stir inside. To be explicit, I thought I heard a sound like a chuckle. but I must have been mistaken. Patience, I said to myself. If you want your machine again, you must leave that Sphinx alone. If they mean to take your machine away, it's little good wrecking their bronze panels. And if they don't mean to keep it, you'll get it back as soon as you can ask for it. Face this world. Learn its ways. Be careful of hasty guesses at its meaning. In the end, you will find clues to it all. And then, the humor of the situation came into my mind. The years I had spent in study and toil to get into the future age, and now, my eagerness to get out of it. So far as I could see, all the world displayed the same exuberant richness as the valley. Here and there, water shone like silver, and beyond, the land rose into hills that faded into the sky. A peculiar feature which presently attracted my attention was the presence of certain circular wells. Several, it seemed to me, of a very great depth. They were sunk into the ground, not far beyond the Sphinx. Sitting by the side of these wells and peering down into the darkness, I could see no gleam of water, nor could I see the bottom by dropping a lighted match down them. But coming out of all of them, from a depth too far to imagine, I heard a sound like some big engine. I also discovered, from the flaring of my matches, a steady current of air flowing down the shafts. I wondered if this world, as pastoral as it was on the surface, was sitting atop an extensive system of subterranean ventilation. Of all that I encountered in my exploration of this new world, I can convey to you only part of it. Life was simple for the Eloi, who were not burdened by the challenge of inquiry. I could see no signs of crematoria, nor anything suggestive of tombs. And something else continued to puzzle me. Among these people, there were no aged or infirm. Is great health to be one of the benefits of our distant future? I examined their great living and sleeping places, but determined that these were only apartments. I could find no machinery, no appliances of any kind. Yet these people were clothed in pleasant fabrics that must at times need renewal. Their sandals, though undecorated, were fairly complex specimens of metalwork. Such things must be created, and yet the little people displayed no creativity. There were no shops, no signs of commerce around them. They spent all their time playing. I could not see how things were kept going. I was never far from thinking about my time machine. Something, I knew not what, had taken it into the hollow pedestal of the White Sphinx. Why? Clearly, curiosity existed somewhere in this foreign world. And for the life of me, I could not imagine. That day, I made a friend of a sort. As I was watching some of the little people bathing in a shallow part of the river, a girl was seized with a cramp and began drifting downstream. The main current ran rather swiftly, but not too strongly for even a moderate swimmer. Yet none of her friends made even the slightest attempt to rescue her. The weakly crying little thing was drowning before their eyes. When I realized this, I hurriedly slipped off my clothes, and wading in at a point lower down, I caught the poor mite and drew her safely to land.
Here. Here now, you're safe. I've got you, see? We're back on dry land. You just swallowed too much water. You'll be all right.
You are the one from the noise in the sky.
Yes. What are you called?
Called?
Your name. Oh, never mind. When you fell into the river, why didn't any of your friends come to save you?
Friends?
Your people. Were they going to let you die?
Food. Now, come.
she ran off, as unconcerned with why the others had abandoned her as with why I had not. But then, coming to know these people, I expected no gratitude from her. As it turned out, I was wrong. This had happened in the morning. In the afternoon, I met my little woman as I was returning from an exploration, and she received me with cries of delight and presented me with a big garland of flowers, evidently made for me and me alone. Soon seated together in a little stone arbor, engaged in conversation, chiefly of smiles. John.
Noise from the sky.
No. My name. My name is John. See him? He is Mindo. John. Mindo. You?
Weena. John?
That's right, John. And you are Weena. The idea that people could have names fascinated Weena. That was the beginning of a friendship that lasted a week and ended, as I will tell you. It was from Weena that I learned that fear had not left the world. She was brave enough in the daylight, or perhaps carefree is a better word, but she dreaded the shadows of the night. I discovered that these little people gathered into the great houses after dark and slept in droves. To enter upon them without a light was to put them into a tumult of apprehension. I never found one out of doors or sleeping alone even within doors after dark. One very hot morning, my fourth, I think, as I was seeking shelter from the heat and glare, there happened this strange thing. I was behind the great dining hall, wandering among the ruins of some long crumbled stone buildings. Climbing among the heaps of ruined masonry, I found a narrow passageway. In contrast with the daylight, it seemed at first impenetrably dark to me. I entered anyway. I groped my way into the makeshift tunnel, for the change from light to blackness made spots of color swim before me. Suddenly I halted, frozen in my steps. At the far end of the tunnel was a pair of eyes. They were luminous, yellow, unblinking, and without pupils, glowing at me from the darkness. I was suddenly seized by a fear of some wild beast. All I could do was clench my hands and stared back into them. I was afraid to turn and run, and then I remembered, man has no threat in the future. Or does he? I also remembered the Eloi's terror of the dark. Both of these powerful emotions battled within me, and I advanced toward the beast.
Show yourself. What manner of creature are you? Come into the light. Don't be afraid. I haven't hurt any of you, have I? I mean no harm. Come here.
Hearing no response, I put out my hand and touched something soft. At once the eyes darted sideways and something white ran past me. Immediately, I was aware of an unmentionable stench. I turned, my heart in my mouth, and stared. The creature ran through a sunlit space between the collapsed slabs of granite, and I saw it. Burned into my mind like a flash picture, ape-like, crawling. It was a dull white with flaxen hair on its head and all down its back. It went too fast for me to see more.
I cannot even say whether it ran on all fours or only with its forearms held very low, dragging on the ground. After I regained my composure, I followed it out of the tunnel and out into the courtyard. But it had vanished. At first, I could not find the creature, but soon came upon one of those round, bottomless openings I'd seen earlier. A sudden thought came to me. Could this thing have vanished down the shaft? I lit a match, and looking down, I saw a small, white, moving creature with large, bright eyes that stared back at me and hastily retreated into the shadow below. The vision made me shudder. It was like a human spider. The monster disappeared, but then I saw for the first time a number of metal foot and hand rests forming a kind of ladder down the side of the shaft. I do not know how long I peered down that well, for it took some time to persuade myself that the thing I'd seen was human. Gradually, the truth dawned. In the hundreds of thousands of years to come, man had not remained one species, but had split into two distinct animals. My graceful Eloi, the children of the upper world, were not the sole descendants of our generation, but that this hideous nocturnal thing which had flashed before me was also heir to the ages. Plainly, this second species of man was subterranean, forced by its underground existence to function solely at night. Its eyes had grown unduly sensitive to the daylight. I also now had a frightening clue to the meaning of the deep wells and to the ventilating towers, to say nothing of the bronze gates and the fate of the time machine. Beneath my feet, then, the earth must be perforated with tunnels, and these tunnelings were the warren of this new breed of man. Were these creatures what allowed the Eloi to play and dine with such mindless abandon? Were these underworld inhabitants the servants whose fate was to provide comfort to the daylight race above? I had to find out, whatever the cost.
Mindo, tell me, are the Eloi the only humans, the only ones like yourselves?
The Eloi live under the sky. There are birds under the sky, and the Eloi are under it.
Well, what about other animals? Other things that live under the sky?
Our food. The food is under the sky, and it is ours.
And how does it get there? Do the Eloi pick the food, sow and harvest it?
It is there for us. It is under the sky, like the Eloi.
Are there any living beings other than Eloi?
There is just the Eloi.
This morning, I saw, under the earth, far away from sky, I saw small and dark, with bright eyes, a creature.
Creature?
Yes, a creature living far, far away from the sky.
Is it Eloi?
No, it lives below the earth, under the ground, in darkness.
Darkness? Under the ground?
Yes. Have you seen it?
Eloi do not see them. They are not Eloi.
Them? There's more than one?
Yes, there are many.
But what are they? Do they do your bidding? Are they your servants? Your slaves? Who are they?
Morlocks. Morlocks!
Wait, don't run away. Who are the Morlocks?
Morlocks, come in darkness. No!
Thank you.
Just a moment, John. Just a moment. I followed your story about the Eloi, but are you saying that they trained wild animals to do their bidding?
No. Not wild animals, Philby, but wild something.
Well, your story sounds so incredible, almost as though you had stumbled on the Garden of Eden.
Stumbled, yes. But the Garden of Eden? Far from it.
What year did you say you had landed in?
802,701.
Oh, well, can you imagine the changes the planet had gone through over those centuries?
The thousands of centuries.
Tens of thousands.
Bosh, gentlemen. Time travel alone is speculation enough. Now are you saying that the human species has become a race of puppies?
If even one of them had evinced your skepticism, Samuel, I would have been delighted beyond measure. For as you'll soon see, the Morlocks were not servants.
Is it your intention to tell us a ghost story, John?
My inquiry terrified these two simple beings. What could the Morlocks be that they could so frighten the Eloi? It came to me in an epiphany. The Eloi and the Morlocks were not master and servant, but two separate life forms.
Now you've taken this too far, John.
Hear my reasoning, Colin, and see for yourself. Think of our society today and the way we build cities to reflect the social order. In our construction of cities, there's a tendency to use the underground for less ornamental purposes. The subways, for instance, or factories built across town, far away from genteel neighborhoods. At first, proceeding from our own age, the gradual widening of the social gap between capital and labor was the key to the whole riddle. Obviously, the schism increased over 8,000 centuries until industry lost its place under the sun and went deeper and deeper into ever larger underground factories. The gulf widened until in the end there were the haves, the Eloi, pursuing pleasure and comfort and beauty, while below there were the have-nots, the workers, the Morlocks, adapting to the confinement of their toil. The pleasure of the world above ground led them to become weak.